Good afternoon, everyone, and thank you for joining us for July's Exotics Club webinar. I'm delighted to welcome back to Webinar Club our speaker for today, lecturer and clinical manager of the Exotic Animal and Wildlife Clinic at the Royal Dick School of Veterinary Studies, University of Edinburgh, Kevin Eatwell. Thank you, Kevin. I'm now going to hand over to you.
Thank you very much, Aima. So today we're talking about setting up an endoscopy suite for exotic animal clinic. And I suppose the questions is why should we be considering adding in endoscopy to our range of options we have available for our pets that come to see us? And I guess the one thing that you've got, which I think makes life much better for me with the endoscopy is I can see what's going on. It's all very well and good having an X-ray, having ultrasound or whatever other imaging you might have been considering, but to directly visualize and see that, it's much more memorable, I guess. And it also allows you to, if you've got the capacity to record that pathology, it gives you a direct comparison to last time. So if you're dealing with a Let's suggest a bird with air sac disease. I can record what it looks like on one day, but I can then record it a month later and do a direct comparison to say, okay, how has this progressed? Are we making an improvement here or not? And I think that's, superior to writing clinical notes. We're going, well, it had it mild, maybe it was moderate, this sort of type thing. It also, of course, allows you to collect material, so you can do some cytology, histopathology. Maybe it's a culture you're looking for, or a viral PCR or something. So it's actually not only are you looking at things here, you're also able to get a diagnosis by trying to demonstrate a host pathological response and things like that. Of course, the downsides is it's invasive. You've got to have the equipment for it. And to some extent, there is an element of having some experience to be able to utilize it effectively. And so these are obviously maybe why it's not first on your list. And I suppose the question is, well, when would you want to do this to a patient? When is this likely to come along? And obviously, a lot of patients are coming in. You might be supporting them for 1 or 2 days, making sure they're happy and stable prior to endoscopy. Bearing in mind, in most cases, this is going to require an anaesthetic. So you've got to have a patient that you are happy to anaesthetize before performing this procedure. And so it is a very distinct possibility, depending on the imaging that you've got available, that you probably already have run radiographs. You maybe have ultrasound scanned the liver first. Maybe you've run a blood profile through looking at things or a CT or something like that. But the chances are you've hopefully, I guess, had a look for anatomical change, if you like, on other imaging modalities. You've looked at the host inflammatory response and things like that, and organ function with your blood work. And now you're moving on to the, I want to actually see what it looks like to try and quantify what it looks like. And obviously, looking at a total bile acid, say, for example, is all very well and good, but that's not the same as looking at how severe the pathology looks when you're looking at the liver directly, for example. So it's not necessarily going to be your first line thing. You've explored other avenues first, and you're looking at maybe getting, in many cases here, a biopsy or something to try and confirm a definitive diagnosis for this patient. So if we're going to start investing in equipment, then we've got to have equipment that we can use across multiple different species. What we find, the smaller the diameter of the endoscope that you wish to use, the less light transmission you get down the endoscope. So if you're looking, say, at flexible endoscopy, say an 8 mm gastroscope, or even a 4 or 5 mm bronchoscope, for example, that you might be using in dog and cat, your image quality is okay for those sorts of things with a flexible endoscopy. Once you start shrinking below the 4 mm on the flexible scopes, the image quality starts to become quite impaired. And that's why really then you resort to switching away from flexible endoscopes into the rigid endoscopes, because you get better light transmission, better quality images for the smaller diameter scope. We also prefer to use rod lens telescopes versus endoscopes. The reason for this is that you've got more glass, less air in the units, basically. You get better and more complete light transmission. So these will give you better quality images than you will do relative to using an old style endoscope. You then have to think about if you said, okay, great, I'm going to go for a rod lens telescope. It's got the light transmission that I need. It's a better thing altogether. The next question is what angle do I want on here? And really, the endoscopes you can get can have different angles on the end. If it's zero, basically, when you're looking forward down the scope, you're looking straight forward. You're looking straight at what you're looking at. If you have an angle at the end of the endoscope, then there is an adjustment needed here because you're actually looking slightly sideways, not end on with the instrument. So we have a 0 degree endoscope here at the top here, and you can see the light is coming out evenly on both sides. I'm looking straight ahead. So if I was looking down, for example, down a trachea, then I would be looking at bang on the center of the trachea in my image would be the center of this endoscope. If I've got a 30 degree endoscope, which is really the most usual working angle that you would have for these items, then I'm looking slightly off to the side. And basically, I'm looking slightly upwards if you hold it in the normal sort of position. So what this means, if I'm going down a tubular organ, is I need to be looking upwards all the way down. Otherwise, if I try and look down the centre, what happens is I'm angling the endoscope, and the bottom part of this endoscope maybe then is risking abrading or damaging or piercing the tubular organ. So you've just got to get used to the fact that if it's a 30-degree angle, always look up and things will be far better for you. If we just take a picture here, this is just an illustration of why this change in angle may be helpful to you. So this is a 0 degree endoscope. I'm looking straight forward and I'm straight on the center of field of view. If I want to look left or right or up or down, I'm going to have to reposition and move my endoscope to allow me to do that. And depending on patient size, I may be quite limited in my ability to move that around. In contrast, a 30-degree angle scope will look at an offset angle. So in here, for example, we're now looking down, as it were, with it, but I'm offset. I can see the centre of field of view and off to one side for that. If I rotate this endoscope around through 360 degrees, so I start looking up, I then look to the right, I then look down, I then look to the left, the actual area that I cover is much wider than I would do with a 0 degree scope. But what I'm doing here is rotating it versus having to change the angle at which I'm looking at. And the angled scopes are much easier for a more detailed evaluation than the 0 degree endoscope. So I would always encourage you to go for a 30-degree angle endoscope. The next thing we've got to think about here is it's one thing looking. But if I'm looking at biopsying for cytology, histopath culture, PCR, what have you, then I've got to have a way of doing that. So this is just one sort of system here, just to show you here. This is a 30-degree angle endoscope at the top here. We've got a little sheath that fits over that to protect the endoscope, and we'll come on to why that's important later, perhaps. But this also fits biopsy forceps or scissors down there as well. The beauty of this with the 30-degree angle is because I'm looking upwards, I'm actually looking right at where these forceps come into the field of view. So instead of trying to strain looking sideways, I'm already looking sideways, so I can see where these instruments come in. The important thing to bear in mind when you're using forceps is you have very fragile metal jaws, which is scissor action here. If you have this mechanism trapped in the sheath here, you will break it. And these obviously cannot tolerate a lot of force either. So when you're watching with your endoscope here, you need to be able to see this mechanism completely before you open your forceps. And in some cases, that may mean you have to just withdraw the endoscope and telescope a little bit to give yourself a little more room to do that. And this is just showing that practically here, this actually is a liver here looking to do biopsies, but I can see these jaws here in view completely. I know my mechanisms are outside the sheath of the telescope, so I'm not going to be damaging it when taking this liver biopsy. The next thing that's relevant, I guess, for these really is what do you want to do? You know, with this, you want to be able to get your biopsies, have a look at everything. And just a couple of pictures here of some very, I guess, old school endoscopy here, where you're actually looking down the lens itself to see what's going on. Now, this is great, you can do that, but as you can see, you've got to be in a certain position to achieve that. And okay, yes, you can try and be a bit more sterile with it, but you're still sticking your head and eye over the eyepiece of the instrument which you're putting into the animal. And the difficulty here is I'm the only person that can see it. I can't record it for anybody so somebody else can see it. And again, I have to contort myself into a position to see it. And to take biopsies with this sort of technique obviously is incredibly difficult. So you do need to start looking at a bit more of equipment, I'm afraid, for these. And the next step is you want some sort of monitor or TV or something that you've got that allows you then to attach a camera to that. The addition of the camera does add weight, but this means basically I can now project these images, if you like, onto a TV screen or a monitor. Everybody in the room can see them. I can see them as well, of course. And it's a much more neutral position to be in. You also have a focusing ring here, which will allow you to focus on items just in front of the endoscope or right the way far distance away. And again, that depends on patient for you as well. So this gives you much more flexibility for them. And basically, the camera just clicks here onto the eyepiece, and then obviously this is taking it away. You have the option here of freezing the image and recording images as well, depending on your setup, so you can actually actively carry on and freeze and record video and images whilst you're performing the endoscopy for archiving or for showing the owner subsequently. And in terms of position for this, of course, being able to stand up, use the endoscope, but physically look at a screen to see what's going on is your next step. And it's again, it's the next sort of level of hand-eye coordination in that you've got to get used to manipulating and moving your hands, but you're not going to watch what your hands are doing. You're going to watch what the endoscope is doing from the camera. So you do want to have this camera positioned in a very neutral position for you. Maybe you shouldn't be standing as in this image, but sitting so you can rest down your elbows and get, you know, very fine motor movement sorted. And then you're able to move things around, manipulate things around, get your biopsies while sitting in an upright position, not fatiguing, able to directly visualize what you're doing. So, having decided that this is something that you want to take forward for your patients, we then of course have to look at what I need to buy, really, I guess. And to some extent, you might go through and look and say, okay, what have I got in my practice already? Is there something knocking around here that they've got that I can utilize here? And obviously, in the first instance, you're going to want to get the endoscope. You're going to want a sheath to protect that endoscope. Depending on the size you're looking at for the exotics, You might be 2.7 millimeters, you might be 2.1 millimeters, that these things can be damaged. So having a sheath present over them will help protect them. You're going to need a light cable that runs from the endoscope with another end that then connects into the light box. Okay, this is a very old halogen box here, but again, it's a question of what you've got in the clinic and what you think you can modify and utilize to try and, I guess, be sensible in terms of how much this is costing for you to get. For the exotic animals, we're really looking at, we always go for the storts. We tend to go for a 2.7 millimeter scope. It's a 30 degree angle on there, 19 centimeters long, and that's a catalog number there for you as well. And then you want to get a protective sheath for this. And this is just an exam sheath. You can't do anything with this. There is an insufflation port on getting air or fluid in. It's quite tight. And if you're certainly wanting to insufflate a patient with CO2, for example, then this is not really suitable. If you want to get biopsies, then you're going to need a surgical sheath with this, which is bigger, which brings the whole sort of system up to maybe 4 millimeters in diameter, not 2.7. And then you want to get some little biopsy forceps on there, which Storz also do, which are the five French biopsies. So this is sort of the setup that we've got. Really, what we're talking about now is we've got our endoscope here. This is the exam sheath, which you would use in most patients to protect it, unless you're down to sort of cockatiel or budgie or something like that. This just locks in place. This, like I say, can be used for insufflation for fluid and air, depending on what you're doing, but the amount you can get down the side of the scope is quite limited. The surgical sheath here allows for a biopsy instrument to be placed down the front here. A little bit of effort is required to get it to turn the corner, and then it will come out directly in the field of view at this end. And these two ports here again allow for insufflation or drainage with air and saline. And because there is more space around this instrument now, if you're going to insufflate a patient, this actually is the better way forward to do that. These are your sort of little biopsies, which we can use for collecting diagnostic samples and basically sit it in its box somewhere so it is safe to stop it being damaged. But have it in a position that's easy to be used, if that makes sense. So if you put this in a box and hide it away, nobody's going to get on and use it. Now, you might be rummaging around in the clinic and you might find that you've got a halogen light source here. And it all is a question of what you find. Some of these may be useful, some of these may be out of date, but it may be something that gets you started. The xenon units you can get access to obviously are far superior to the halogen bulbs in terms of getting adequate light transmission. And the color rendering index of this is more normal. You don't get that yellowing sort of color. This is more a real true reflection of the color of the organs that you're dealing with. Light cables. Doesn't really matter what light cable you get, to be honest. Generally, it's the endoscope size that is the limiting point for light transmission through these. This is a Storz specific cable. It's quite nice, it's quite lightweight, so it doesn't really pull on you much when you're manipulating and assessing these. And you must obviously make sure you have sufficient spare cable that you can do that sensibly. An alternative for you, this is a heavier gauge cable here. But the reason for putting this in here is this one is one that has a capacity for multiple adaptations. So you can fit different endoscope ends on this side, and this side will fit into different light sources. So this is a Storz light source. Sorry, this is a Storz light source fitment, for example. This is Olympus, and this is another unit now for a different one as well. So if you've got that old light source in the clinic, and you bought yourself another one, they're two different brands. With this cable, you can use either. If one bulb goes and you've got to buy a new bulb, you can use your backup light source by just switching the end on this cable, and that works really quite nicely. When it comes to what you're going to do with these items, then we've got to think about What out of these can I autoclave? What out of these can't I autoclave? The endoscopes can be, but depending on brand that you get, but it may reduce their lifespan. Your light cables, you cannot autoclave, much as this one has been sterilized here, but we use ethylene oxide gas for these. If you autoclave the light cable, you've had it, you're going to melt the whole thing. So much as you might want to autoclave the surgical sheaths and the instruments, the endoscope and the light cable, you're probably not going to be putting them through your autoclave. You're going to have to think of a different way of getting these sterile for use for sterile endoscopy. You can get basically manufacturer recommended disinfectants and cleaners as well for them to do that, and obviously this allows you to do maybe quicker succession. This is Medizyme here, which is the instrument cleaner which we use to clean our endoscopes and cables and things, and then what we actually have is Medis, which is a disinfectant equivalent, and these are able to soak in the Medis solution for 20 minutes to sterilize them, and of course light cables and things can go through as well. We rinse this off thoroughly afterwards and dry it, so obviously we don't want to be causing an irritation to tissues here with the disinfectant, so these are drained and rinsed thoroughly before use with sterile lavage fluid in theatre. The next thing you'll want to think about then is your camera and what's happening with that. You're going to need a light box for your endoscope, which, okay, in this picture here, this is our xenon, but we're going to need the capacity for recording from your camera, so you're going to need a camera box. This is where the end of the camera clicks in here, and obviously at the back of this, then you've got cables that are going to your monitor off to the side here, so you can actually see the images displayed. This is white balance, again quite important if you want to manage how your image is looking, and obviously this is light intensity here, but obviously you do get rate limiting with the small scopes how much is going to come through based on the endoscope size. So basically with your camera it's quite simple. This goes to your scope, focusing here, freezing and videoing, and this clicks into your light box. So having collected these things together, you need to try and create some sort of setup for use. And again, it boils down to, I guess, in terms of what money you've got. This is a setup that we used to have. This is a catering trolley that cost £75, but it's stainless steel, so it was quite a cheap purchase. And what we've got here, we've got light source, camera box, monitor. We've actually gone so far here as to have a DVD recorder running between the camera and the monitor, so this basically allows us to record DVDs to archive them. We've got a medicine medizyme here for sterilization. Cautery here, very old cautery now, and this actually is for insufflation, which we'll come on to in due course. And all our instruments, of course, are kept here safely secure but immediately access and ready. So you can get away with doing something on this on a fairly low budget if you need to try and save on your finances. This is an ex-hospital unit we were able to acquire. Again, it's a proper endoscopy tower, so this is what they should look like, I guess. This now is a much improved monitor, but again, we've got the Medis here, we've got the scopes, xenon light source, camera box, DVD, insufflator, and obviously all our instruments are now on the bottom as well. And you've got to position this really directly in front of you, to be honest, or just off to the side with the patient in between you and this, for the maximum sort of comfort whilst doing the endoscopy. You do have to think about your surgical kits, how you're going to gain access to them. Vast majority of cases here, you're going to be using a fine kit that you've got in use anyway. Small pair of hemostats or Metzenbaums will be useful for making incisions to go in for patients, and if you're insufflating, you may want to have some PDS or something to suture around these to try and create a seal for your lizards, for example, to allow you to insufflate adequately. Your camera, of course, is a problem because you cannot autoclave your camera, you cannot cold sterilize your camera. Again, if you do that, you're just going to destroy your camera. The camera, sadly, has to be non-sterile. So you need to be set up really with the camera ready to go in a non-sterile fashion. It clicks over the back of the endoscope here. And if you want to maintain your sterility, then you'll need to get a camera sheath. Variety of these available. This particular one here has an elasticated bit on one end which clicks around here. And this is basically a long sheet of plastic with a solid ring beyond that. These are about £10-12 each, so they're not a cheap consumable to be utilizing. What they allow you to do, however, of course, is you've got it clicked around here, and there's a little bit of tape. You can also tape it around here. Generally, we would tape between the ring and the back of the endoscope here. If you bring it forward here, sometimes that can be interfering depending on how deep within the patient you're going. This is then just pulled out over the cable, and this is all sterile right the way down to floor level. So when this is draping across your drapes, in the same way that we've gas sterilized the light cable here, you're aiming to, you don't want to be contaminating your surgical field with your cables. Again, obviously, having done that, relatively easy to manipulate and move around. You've got to have flexibility in your cables. You need enough slack that you can do this easily and effectively. Biopsies are possible through this route. This is an older picture here, and I think, to be fair, we would perhaps be changing things a little bit here. Yes, we're lovely and sterile. We're biopsying single-handed here. I'm holding the sheath down here, supporting it low down here, so I've got that weight supported by my hand down here. You wouldn't do this if you didn't have an endoscope sheath in place. We've got a grey parrot here having a biopsy, but realistically, we probably should have blue drapes up here, across here, and across there, to ensure that we've got a sterile field off the edge of the table here, because obviously I'm contaminating myself here. We tend in many cases to leave the head open just so the nurses can see the patient and see it breathing and make sure we haven't dislodged the tube. But we extend the plastic drape as far as we can in this direction for maintaining sterility. And I suppose the question is, you've got to start getting used to using this. You've got to work out how you're going to utilize this modality. And I think there's lots of things where we could use endoscopy that we just simply don't. So just put a rabbit here. This is a rabbit having a dental. Purest, simplest thing in the world. You could write down and scribble on a dental chart what's going on, or just relay some clinical notes across to somebody else. Or you can practice using your endoscope in its sheath for stomatoscopy, as we would call it. And this allows you to have a detailed visual interpretation of the teeth so you can see exactly what is happening as you're going through that process. And this is just one example here where we're able to take a little video here showing the teeth, but showing that we've got pyorrhea present here. We've got pus coming up the side of this tooth from the bone, so we do have an osteomyelitis, and maybe this might be one we can extract orally and clean and flush that socket. But I've got a direct visual recording of that, and I can use this to show to the owner, I can put it on the clinical notes, this sort of type thing. Far, far superior to trying to describe this to an owner without them physically seeing. And I guess with all of these, it is about trying to get increased owner compliance, to get them to do what you need them to do to improve their circumstances and situations for the patients, and anything you can do that gives you leverage to help that is, of course, a bonus. Having got used to using your endoscope in orifices, I guess, in terms of doing oral endoscopy, in doing esophageal or gastric endoscopy, maybe in a snake, although you'd have flexible for a snake. We do the same in ferrets to some extent. Very difficult to get esophageal endoscopy in the small rodents just because of the presence of food. You might be using up the cloaca of a bird, down the esophagus of a bird, into somebody's ear, upper trachea, really quite a collection of things, looking at the back of a nose or going up a nose. There's lots of uses for the rigid endoscope where you've already got, I guess, a working area. We tend to use saline insufflation if you're in the lower GI tract and air for the upper respiratory, upper GI tract, just obviously to try and avoid the risk of aspiration of fluid. If we move on to laparoscopy, really, I suppose there's two circumstances which lend themselves to it very nicely, and that's birds and snakes, where we can utilize their pre-existing air sacs to evaluate them, so they're already insufflated for us. Now, for the birds, we traditionally use the left side in the birds. This is because the gonads on the left side, spleen's on the left side, so we can determine gender and have a look at spleen and things. Have a look at proventriculus. Works quite well. And for these, you're basically making a little hole and going into the either the caudal thoracic or the abdominal air sacs to get into this patient, and that allows you to have a detailed evaluation around. And you could argue if you've been a good person and you've done your imaging beforehand, firstly, that's necessary maybe to make sure that it is safe, that there is sufficient air sac space that you can put this in safely, so you're not going to suddenly hit the liver or they've got an ascites or an egg or something. But equally, you'll be able to have a guide for the level of pathology and decide if you want to do endoscopy on both sides or one side, and you might pick on the worst side, for example. For these, again, it's sterile preparation for them. For the birds, we try and minimise plucking, and we just use Durepore or Micropore tape to keep the feathers out of the way, obviously marking our rib cage back and aiming to go in just in front of the back leg, really, in front of the leg muscle mass, either behind the last rib or between the last two ribs of the birds to get in. But this allows you quite a nice entry point to have a reasonable look around in these species. Snakes are your next ones on your list. Now, okay, it depends on species whether you've got one lung or two lungs. The snakes really are long and thin, so everything sort of works from front to back. And we know that the sort of the junction between lung tissue, which obviously if you were to puncture lung tissue, you've got the risk of increased hemorrhage. Whereas if you were going for wanting air sac, then you're around about sort of 45% of the snout to the vent length. This sort of guarantees you almost a pitch in through the air sac wall where the respiratory membranes have pretty much died back. Fairly blood-free surgery at this point, but you're still able to look cranially up into the lung and actually can go right through up into trachea in a lot of cases, or go caudally investigating air sac or transilluminating through the air sac, looking at the liver, for example, on these guys. So works very well for the snakes, for I guess primarily used for pneumonia really, or respiratory signs. You're just making a little incision between two of the ribs, and then you're popping in and having a little look around and seeing what's going on in that snake. And that's quite a useful little technique. Again, you probably already performed some diagnostics, but in many cases with the snakes, you're probably going to maybe run some bloods or something. But there's, I guess, more of an indication for doing endoscopy in the snakes as a primary thing more than the birds per se, simply because radiographically, it's very difficult to get radiographs that are practically useful of the chest of snakes. I'd almost bypass that step and go straight for endoscopy with the snakes, to be honest. And this is again just a picture showing you that. Very easy to do. Popping in, we're set up again. Maybe we should have more blue drapes on this side of the picture here. But we're able to go in and evaluate this snake's, take biopsies for PCR, for paramyxovirus, or for culture, or for histopath, and find out what's going on. However, if you're going to look at doing laparoscopy in other species, then obviously we've got to think about those because these aren't insufflated. Now we've got to do something ourselves to do that for us. The only time we do have a quick cheat here, I guess, is the chelonians, where their bladder is so big and they have a very wide urethra on the bladder which joins to the cloaca that you can actually perform cystoscopy in the chelonians and get a reasonable evaluation of the internal organs by just flattening the bladder against them. So there is a bit of a cheat in the tortoises, but they do need to be anaesthetized for that. And obviously you can't biopsy because you'll be making a hole in the bladder. If you need to go in laparoscopically for anybody else, then we've got to obviously make a hole and insufflate them. Now, body wall thickness can be a problem for these. Maybe we should be putting body wall thinness is a problem because obviously the anchoring of your trocars can be very difficult, and the slightest movement you can be in 1 minute and out the next. So we tend to be using the Turmanian-tipped trocars here, and this actually gives you a little bit more security in the body wall. And we actually suture these in place. We actually put a mattress suture around them, a PDS or something, to suture them into the muscle layer afterwards to hold it in place. And that seems to work quite well. We're going to place these under direct visualization as best as we can do, so your risk of puncture again is reduced. And if we just look at some of the trocars you might be considering using for laparoscopy, this is your sort of standard one here, but I mean, you're literally pushing in on the spike, and it just slides in as it goes, and obviously the risk here is quite. Risk of damage is quite high because there's nothing to stop you sliding in too much here. Now you can get stops that you can fit on here, rubber stops to stop them going in. In the same way, if you were using the endoscope in a bird, you might use your fingers around the stem of the endoscope to stop it going in too deep. You can put a bung on these to stop these from advancing too quickly. But again, there's nothing here to hold this in place. In contrast, this is a modified cannula now, with basically a threaded trocar on it. So here, yes, you're pushing through, but I can thread this in now. It's not going to suddenly go in. And if I want to suture this in place, I can suture the body wall around it, anchored into these threads. So much more robust and secure than you're going to get from this design. The first hole, however, you're going to make for these will be for the endoscope. This is one designed for the endoscope, and what you have, this is a Turmanian tip here, and you basically make a tiny little nick through your what is thin body wall through into the peritoneal cavity, a bit like what you would do for the first sort of little incision for a rabbit spay or something. But then you can thread this underneath the body wall, with this being on the top side, and slowly spin it whilst your endoscope is in there, if you like, watching. To go through to make sure that you're not damaging anything. And obviously, you can go through a few turns on the screw, as it were, and again, you can mattress this in place. Having done that, you then have the opportunity to insufflate with basically carbon dioxide, will be the most usual for these. There's a special little valve in here that stops air leaking back out via the scope hole, but if you insufflate through here, then you're going to get much better visualization. You're creating a little bit of space within that body cavity so you can work. And certainly, then, if you're going to subsequently be putting in this style of trocar, then obviously you can watch that trocar being placed. And because you've got a 30-degree angle on the endoscope, you can just rotate it around and see the body wall and see it coming in. You wouldn't be able to do that as eloquently with a 0-degree endoscope. For the insufflation, then you need a CO2 insufflator. This is a second-hand unit we got. Again, ex-hospital, works very well. In essence, you've got a couple of things on here that is pertinent. This is the pressure the system is going to inflate the abdomen to, and when you've achieved the pressure, it will stop pushing more gas in. And you can set this in millimeters of mercury. A lot of our patients, around 5, maybe 10, depending. They're much smaller than the mammals, so you don't want to be putting too much pressure into their abdomens. Next thing you've got here is your flow rate. This can be modified through a small, medium, or high amount of CO2 coming in. Again, it's dependent on leakage, dependent on size of abdomen you've got to fill. One is normally adequate. And then this gives you an idea of how much volume that you have actually instilled into your patient, how much volume of carbon dioxide has been used here. And this basically goes out to your endoscope, connects onto one of the endoscope ports, and is pushing the CO2 in. The thing, of course, you've got here is that you're now going to be compressing the abdomen, and that obviously is something that you need to bear in mind because this is going to have an impact. You've got to breathe against this. This is going to push the diaphragm cranially or collapse the lungs in a lizard, for example. And then obviously you've got to compensate for that by putting a bit more effort into the breathing. So realistically then, you do need capnography to assess suitable breathing, and also realistically, you need a decent cap ventilator to allow you to mechanically breathe for them. So this is impact three here, just one of the units that we use, multi-purpose parameter. But what I want to know is, am I ventilating adequately here? Is my CO2 coming out of this patient adequately? Because if that isn't, I've then either got to increase my respiratory frequency, or maybe increase the volume of that I'm putting in, or the pressure to compensate for the pressure in the abdomen. We use pressure cycling ventilators for that. This is another Vetronix product here, but again, we're giving pressure here in centimeters of water to combat against the pressure from the CO2, and this is determining how much or how long our expiration is. Bear in mind, if you suddenly stop insufflating the abdomen, you may overinflate the lungs due to the pressure set on here. So it may be you want to lower down your ventilation pressure just before you lower down your abdominal CO2 pressure in your patients. If you're looking at doing surgery, then obviously a collection of instruments will be needed, ranging from graspers through biopsies through to scissors here for manipulation inside the animal. These simply have handpieces that attach. These rotate these instruments around, and this here is for a unipolar cautery attachment here, so you can actually, after you've taken your biopsies, you can go back and cauterize the biopsy site, for example. If you're looking at dealing with bigger vessels, this actually is a neonatal or pediatric bipolar cautery system here with two little tongs here that you can use for bipolar cautery over a major vessel inside the abdomen as well, if you're doing some sort of spay or something perhaps where you would want that. So you've got to get your cautery set up. It's quite handy if you're whatever cautery you end up picking on or choosing, use ones that are multi-purpose. Use ones you can use in open surgery as well. Then obviously you've got as much use out of them as you can do. You're just literally switching the leads onto a different instrument depending on what you require. And I'm afraid you've got to practice. This is the next level of problem here for these guys. You have to practice and set up a little trainer. And depending what procedures you're doing, but the best in the world, you've got two hands. This means you can control two instruments at a maximum point yourself. Now that may be you're able to have an endoscope in one, and it may be you're able to then go for having a biopsy forceps in the other. But again, if you want absolute control of these instruments, you do need to be holding on to the back of the unit via the camera, and also at the point of entry into the abdomen, particularly for the endoscope. So it may be you're going to have to partner up with a friend. One person is going to be responsible for driving and allowing you to see and manipulate the endoscope around inside that patient. And you're going to be basically then doing the surgical procedure under their watchful eye. And then you have to work together such that you both maintain in visual contact, as it were, during that process. And just this silly little thing like they set up with, a bit of blue tack, paper clip stretched out, and some polo mints, and you're stacking your polo mints over the end of the paper clip, for example, or you're trying to stack little sugar cubes or something. But something just to get used to that hand-eye coordination and looking at a monitor to do it, not looking at your hands. It's the screen you want to be focusing on here. And if there's two of you, of course, then you've got to work out how you're going to position yourself in theatre to make this practical and functional. You need to work out what your target is. You need to be a sensible distance back from your target so you can see it in view to get your liver biopsy, whatever you're doing, on that patient. Does require a fair bit of instrumentation, second surgeon, lots of draping. You may be having to be in a position that you've got to manipulate your patient around, which again boils down to then airway security, and maybe any complications you get from moving or dislodging that airway. This circumstance here now, just to again show you what we're doing here, this is the scope sheath that's been fixed in place. This is insufflation here. This is the scope now with a protective sheath being used. Camera obviously in place, tied as we said behind here. Relatively enough cable knocking around, so we're able to go in now in an insufflated abdomen, and I can go around and look. And in this case, for example, want to do a liver biopsy, then obviously I'm in a fairly good position to do that, but I'd need a second port coming in to allow me to do that. Again, you've got to think about where are all my things going. I need to be able to see and visualize what's happening inside my patient easily and clearly from where I'm standing, and also be able to do the surgery or biopsies that I need to do whilst I'm doing that. And again, you can see here with the camera sheath, you've got a lot of cable here. You can drape this across your instrument tray to try and keep as much sterility as you can do over a longer distance. There are cases, of course, when you're looking at what kit to buy, that you might be thinking about you want something portable. It's lovely having all this expensive kit out back, but it's also very nice to be able to show the owners as well. And this little unit we've got here is absolute godsend. So this is a little handheld unit, really. Runs off a battery, which is quite nice. This also fits into the main endoscopy as well, so you don't have to run off this battery. You can run off the xenon light source if you wanted to. Clicks into a camera. Again, you can click into your normal camera with your DVD and monitor, but this just clicks into a lovely little patient side monitor here. So we can actually take this little unit, or to be honest, any endoscope, because we can just switch the endoscope here. We can have a longer, thinner one if you wanted, but this can go into the consult room. We've got the battery in place. We've got a little video of what we're looking at. So if I was to, for example, wanting to show an owner dental disease, or I want to look down an ear, then I can do this. I've got the instant compliance there, in the consult room, saying, look, this is what the ear looks like, this is what the teeth look like, and this is quite a robust otoscope that we would utilize in for this particular instance. The advantage for this, we do a lot, obviously we do see a lot of otitis externa and otitis media, particularly in the lop-eared rabbits. And if we're dealing with cases where we don't have any signs of bullous destruction, then we do have the option, of course, of going in and doing deep cultures and flushing of these for their otitis media and a GA. And this little unit works absolutely brilliantly for that. Your endoscope fits in, you've got the camera on, we've got the capacity now to slide down sterile catheters down in. You can use these to perform a meningotomy to get access to the middle ear if you just had an otitis media, say in a pointy-eared rabbit. But if you've got an externa and a media, then obviously you can work your way through the exterior material, puncture through ear dem, and then gain access to the middle ear. And to be honest, the middle ear has long since been involved anyway. The eardrum probably has ruptured a long time ago. But it does allow you for more thorough medical treatment for these patients, and obviously is superior for management of ear disease in these individuals. This is the end of the webinar, but we do have a question that's been brought up, actually just literally just arrived, about ear disease. Just a couple of questions on that. First thing to answer, the first question here is, how much do we see? And it's lop rabbits. We see loads in the lop rabbits due to the distortion of their vertical canal. Certainly this system can be used to look at otitis externa and get cytology and look at that. But if you're wanting to try and confirm otitis media, then you do need other imaging to get that. And realistically, it's sending them for a CT to get a detailed analysis of the middle ear. And as I said, for these where we've got no bullet destruction and the ear canal, the vertical ear canal is relatively anatomically normal, then we may be looking at flushing in this sort of situation using the endoscope. If we've got damaged to the tympanic bulla, or there is distortion of the external ear canal, then that would be pushing that candidate into basically salvage surgery, where we would do a partial ear canal ablation and a bullar osteotomy for that. So this really is one of the tools that we're using to manage otitis in the rabbits, but surgery still obviously is still quite a significant element of that. I'm going to pass you back to Emma now. Thank you very much for attending.
On behalf of Webinar Club, I'd like to thank Kev for a great presentation today. The recording and the certificate for this webinar will be available in the next few days in the members area of Webinar Club. Thank you all for attending. That's the end of the webinar.